Hello. Welcome back to our usual No Place, No Welcome. I hope everyone is managing in health and strength under the difficult circumstances we all face. I want to begin with a discussion of the tech projects for the term. We have a good opportunity now in our separateness to work on some basic technologies of privacy for you, which, regardless of what else you may be using, made by Sauron the Magnificent, or maybe downloading from the Dukes of Redmond or whatever, it can help you to have a more secure and more private life in the net we do not want. I think we'll substitute a series of tech projects for the required second essay. I am way behind in editing, but I will have comments and suggestions for improvement on your first essay back to you by the end of the first weekend in April. And I hope that you will find both revising the first essay and working in the journal and writing a second essay, if you feel like it, to be good for you where you are. But in view of the pass-fail nature of the term and the fact that it does not require more of your time and effort to figure out whether you pass or not than we can get from one essay, I want at least to relieve people of burden who are going to have to deal with Zoomified classes and secure multiple choice exams and all sorts of other pedagogical nonsense to have the room to do that. But in lieu of a required second essay, again, I want to stress you're more than welcome to write one, and I will edit and work on it with you by all means. But in lieu of the required second essay, I think I want to substitute the series of tech projects, and I have posted the first one. Projects concerning secrecy, we can also make accountable. That is to say, I can set up the project in such a way that we can verify that you have succeeded. And this first project, verification, is crucial. We needn't talk again about the history of PGP or why it was that Philip Zimmerman decided to make pretty good privacy, or why it was that the United States government decided to try and put him in jail for doing it, or what it was that I had to do with the fact that he didn't go. That's all a story for another time. Let us say that from 1991, when the first version of Pretty Good Privacy was published by Mr. Zimmerman on the precursors of the current World Wide Net, it was possible for individuals around the world to have strong, that is, industrial strength, that is, military-grade public key encryption for everyone. The point of public key encryption, the ability to send absolutely secure messages between parties who have not previously shared a secret, was the crucial mathematical importance of the achievements of Rivest and Shamir and Edelman that went into the so-called RSA cryptographic system, the first fully usable form of public key encryption presented to the world. The advantage of the public key encryption is the advantage of that night deposit drawer on the side of the bank. The bank can put on the street side a lock to which many people have the key. In fact, they can hand out as many night deposit keys as they have depositors who might need one. And then you can come by and use the public key on the front side of the building to open the drawer and put a deposit in, which will then be securely whisked away to the other side of the array on the inside of the building, where only the bank has the key that allows it to open up and retrieve the deposits. Throughout the digital world, every time you use an HTTPS-equipped website or in any other way engage in the structure of secure communications on the net, you're likely to be using a form of public key encryption. The website security system assumes that on the public side there's a key that anybody can use to communicate securely with it, and on the web server side there's a key that can be used to unlock the communications sent to the website and then forwarded back out to your browser, which has temporarily made a key for secure communication with the server. It also allows authentication, that is to say, because the server answers to its public key, which some security authority like VeriSign or, for that matter, Let's Encrypt has agreed is its key, because it will be able to answer challenges to you, then you can be sure that it is indeed Citibank or whoever it is that you want to be sure you're communicating with and not the criminal syndicate pretending to be Citibank. In any event, the public key encryption systems built into the web exist now because Philip Zimmerman didn't go to jail for making pretty good privacy. That is, because a war on encryption control by the United States government successfully wrenched free our right to communicate in encrypted fashion and to share the systems for encrypted communication with people outside the United States around the world. That's what makes it possible to have a net that ever keeps any secrets at all. So the legal history of PGP is important, and we can't think very effectively about what it would mean to have digital rights in the 21st century without the struggle over the legality of PGP. But the important thing now isn't to appreciate its legal history or to pat ourselves on the back for having cared enough about it to have tried to keep Mr. Zimmerman out of jail. The important thing to do is to learn how to use it. So technical exercise number one involves getting a version of the Open PGP standard, because Mr. Zimmerman wrote free software and everybody then could de facto standardize on his method for exchanging public key encrypted documents and files, and ultimately that became a standard sufficient in the open source world, that Open PGP can be done by any number of different programs, some for the proprietary operating systems and lots of them for free software. But in the free software world, we mostly use GNU Privacy Guard, GPG, which is the free software world's most capable, strongest, most long-lasting version of the PGP standard. At any rate, you acquire an Open PGP capable encrypting and decrypting program, and perhaps you integrate it into your mail tool, and certainly you go through the task of generating a public-private key pair, that is to say, a public key that you can post on the key servers, that anybody in the world can find and use, that you can email to somebody to say, here, if you want to communicate securely with me, here is my public key. Encrypt the message or the files you are sending to my public key, and then, like the night deposit box at the bank, only my private key will open those messages. So you can, without having any shared secret with me, without ever having met me, without ever having had any basis for confidential communication with me, you can look up my public key and send me a secure message. That's the value of public key encryption. What you're doing when you acquire an Open PGP client and you make a key pair and you post the public part of that key on the key servers and you have the secret part of that key on your key ring, what you have done is to facilitate in all contexts of life secure email and secure file exchange. Now it becomes possible for anybody else to do exactly the same things you have done, to acquire a PGP client and to set it up, and you know how to do that, so you can teach anybody how to do that. So they then also will have a public key and a private key, and immediately all email that is exchanged between the two of you can stop being postcards and start being secure communications. And you have a way to encrypt any files or collection of files that you might want to exchange, and to exchange those files completely securely over public networks. This would allow you to use simple web uploading. I do not mean Dropbox, but simple web uploading on any web server to share any collection of files securely, because they are GPG encrypted to the public keys of the people you want to be able to receive them, and nobody else in the world, and we do mean pretty much nobody else in the world, including the best teams in the world, unless they have stolen the keys on the other side, which is what they always do. But in any event, nobody less than the very best teams in the world has a chance in hell of reading or modifying or understanding the files you've exchanged. With the ability to keep secrecy comes also the ability to assure identity. That is to say, with OpenPGP compatible clients, you can sign documents. And that means that the party who receives that document from you can be sure that it was you who sent it, and can be sure that it hasn't been modified in transit, which is the fundamental requirement for any legally effective signature system. So OpenPGP equipped programs can provide signature certificates which are indicative of the authenticity of authorship and the unchanged state of documents transmitted over untrustworthy networks. With a little bit more activity around it, it can also therefore also authenticate the time of signing. And that will allow for all the necessary parts of any legally sufficient structure for making documents, demonstrating chains of custody, authenticating evidence, and etc., to work in the digital realm based solely on top of the OpenPGP capability you already have. So there's a great deal of effective outcome from this project, both in capacity you then have within your own technological environment to create secrets, to save secrets, to share secrets in a confidential manner, to provide for signature which is authentic, was self-authenticating, and which assures document integrity without the data mining third party DocuSign type people in the middle. And all of that out of the one basic atomic ability, which is to speak PGP. So this first project has a great deal of functional outcome, and we will use it at subsequent stages in order to achieve additional effects in subsequent projects. But for now, operationally, it's pretty simple. Acquire some software, set up some software, generate a key and put the key on the key servers, and then you can engage in secure emailing with me. You have my public key available, which you can find or have already found. You can encrypt email to that email address, mogren@columbia.edu or whatever it is you're accustomed to using. Then I can acquire your key from the key servers and return an encrypted reply to you, which you can then open and read. That proves that you have a secure published identity through your GPG public key. You have been able to encrypt correspondence to me, and you've been able to decrypt and read an encrypted reply, so we know that the circle is complete. This is the project. The instructions are on the course homepage, please complete it at your leisure over the course of the next week. And then project number two, for use of secure geographically unlinked web surfing, will come around. All right, so that's our first tech project as part of the remodeling of course content for the circumstances in which we find ourselves. I don't have much more to say about pedagogy, except to point out that the attendance at last week's class hour on Wednesday afternoon on Etherpad was light to nil. It's a time to come and talk about the reading and what I've talked about if you want to. Unlike Zoomified legal education, I'm not taking attendance. You're not required to show up any more than you were required to show up in the physical classroom. But I do believe that there is at least a little bit of additional value that you might be able to get from this course by coming to class hours. The same is true of the open office hour later on Wednesday afternoons, 4 to 6 p.m., 4:30 to 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and on Thursday mornings from 10:30 to noon. But if you're in another time zone altogether far away and those Etherpad office hours don't work for you and you want to set up some other way to be in touch with me, please do. I am grateful to those who are maintaining their journals, and I am benefited by reading them. If you ask questions in your journal, I will answer them. I'm sorry that that too is slower than I think it's going to be, but it turns out that when you are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in the same room, you can't also work 24 hours, 7 days a week in the same room. And I, like you, am trying to figure out how to balance all the different personality states that we have, all of which respond to the current situation by saying, that's not my life. Mental health, like physical health, is difficult to maintain these days, and everybody suffers just a little bit. So I'm certainly not entitled to any particular sympathy because I'm a slower editor in isolation than I am when I'm not in isolation. But if you have asked a question in your journals and I haven't answered it yet, please hang on. I will be there. If there are other ways in which we can maintain contact which are preferable for you, please don't hesitate to send email or write in a journal and tell me that you want to have a telephone call or whatever it is that the state of complete social distancing between us will allow. So much then for all the material which isn't the material before us, as it were. Let's remind ourselves of the pivot of Part 6, the First Congress's Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution and its Bill of Rights. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. Last time I spent some effort on the archaeology of the Sixth Amendment, that is, unearthing the English criminal procedure history that lay behind it. Most of our analytic effort I directed at the question of the impartiality of the jury in an age of social networking and data mining. I think before returning to the American constitutional, historical, social situation, it might be well to pull back just a bit to the larger context in which this conversation with the past is going on. On the one hand, it's obvious that the Sixth Amendment's particular focus on criminal trial procedure, whatever may have been its English historical roots or the nature of 17th century English criminal prosecutorial politics, the essence analytically beyond the immediate historical situation of the Sixth Amendment is the enormous difficulty of securing the civil freedom of individuals when the state has great force of informational power. Informational power, I say, after all, is the subject of the Sixth Amendment. That is to say, all of the questions about trial rights are really questions about information flow. That the trial must be speedy and public, that the jury must be impartially chosen, that the evidence shall confront the defendant and be given an opportunity to cross-examine or test it, that the accused shall have the power to summon witnesses so that the ability to make a case is roughly equivalent between the state and the defendant, and that there shall be counsel. All of this is really about the question of how information establishing truth and therefore guilt is to be allocated. The Sixth Amendment doesn't say directly anything about criminal discovery, but you see how the entitlement to the possession of exculpatory evidence in Brady against Maryland flows directly out of the requirements of confrontation and assistance of counsel. The Sixth Amendment doesn't say anything about pretrial efforts by government to acquire more information from a defendant, but as United States against Messiah shows, it's easy for the Supreme Court to recognize that if the right of counsel is to be made effective, then obviously it will not be feasible to allow the state to have an opportunity to interview the defendant in the absence of his lawyer during the period between indictment and trial. In this sense, then, you can think of the Sixth Amendment as a set of individual provisions concerning the informational asymmetry of the government prosecuting and the defendant attempting, with the benefit of counsel, to make a defense. And you can see those individual points within the Sixth Amendment's overall architecture, historically related as we showed them to be last time, as nonetheless setting forth a contour. They are a set of points, but as usual, it does us good to remember that this is a sentence, an idea. And that the idea in this respect, not the only respect in which it is sensible to think of the totality of the Sixth Amendment, but is in this context an idea about equalization of information access, about an effort to keep powers' secrecy from overwhelming the defendant's right to a procedural opportunity. Sometimes the Anglo-American adversary model of criminal justice is referred to as involving a sporting theory of justice, a fair chance for the defendant to escape punishment, but it is hard in the context of 21st century life to take very seriously the idea of the survival of a sporting theory of justice. The background to our understanding of the Sixth Amendment and its associated ideas in the 21st century is the background of overwhelming information asymmetry. To be sure, as we noted in the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment, this is not an asymmetry arising only from an overwhelming power in the state, in its own operational existence, although that too, of course, has happened in the transformation from the beginning of the 20th century to the first third of the 21st, the state is enormously capable of collecting and preserving information, and it does on a scale never before imagined in the history of the state as part of civilization in this phase of the human journey. But also, of course, because of the rise in the web we do not want, of the intermediary service platforms financed by data mining, the surveillance capitalism institutions of the world, which also, of course, have their own overt and covert relationships to government. But all of that badly designed social media, so-called, that y'all use, all this form of I have a service that you could do for one another for no cost whatever on your own little machines, but I will do it for you for no cost on my enormous machines, and all I will charge you for the services I am providing to you that you could easily make for yourselves is all your behavioral data all the time everywhere you go about everything. In this respect, we should comment on the two pieces of news I felt it was necessary to put on the radar for you in your in-isolation or seclusion radar. The first, of course, about the fact that the present epidemiological crisis all around the human race is being met all around the human race with more surveillance, because tracking and tracing is regarded under the conditions of a public health emergency as a good thing to do. And because we do want to do the basic work of epidemiology, or at least sometimes we want to do it, and some of our governments are sort of inclined to do it in sort of a way, but at any rate, as long because we know that the way of dealing with epidemic disease is to trace all the contacts which can represent the points of communication for the illness, we naturally see the technology around us that tracks and traces us all the time as an appropriate vehicle for the conduct of public health in a time of emergency. The European Union, as you see, is particularly concerned, as is its role in global politics these days, with the privacy consequences of asking the telecoms to turn over all their data for use in tracing. And the United States government is AWOL in so many of the matters concerning the epidemic that we have not yet seen a large-scale discussion of the use of telecoms data for tracing, because we have no testing sufficient to make the test, trace, and quarantine traditional approach of epidemiology work. But pretty much everywhere where there is a government interested in tracking and tracing, whether for epidemiological or for non-epidemiological reasons, does not really matter, and where there isn't the European brow-clutching and face-palming on the subject of privacy, governments are moving tout de suite to collect as much movement data in the population from the telecoms operators as they can. As usual, with respect to claims that, oh, but it is anonymized data, you should respond with total disbelief. We have good existing studies demonstrating that given, quote, anonymized data from people's mobile phones, it takes 3 to 7 observations of the phone to identify the person who carries it, because oddly enough, people sleep in the same place pretty much all the time, and any trace of an even an anonymized handset, which includes a measurement indicative of where the owner of the handset sleeps and where the owner of the handset works, or even under epidemic conditions, one cell adjacent to where the owner of the handset sleeps, and you pretty much have a small set of choices with respect to whose handset that may be. So the claim that what this is anonymized data would better be addressed by saying that it is data from which identity information has been lightly scrubbed. But the collection of all that data and the pinpointing of everybody's movements all the time is a step further in the direction of the mass surveillance as opposed to surveillance structure, the elimination of the idea of privacy in our movements. Of course, though this is a work of extraordinary oppressiveness on the part of governments choosing to make the use of the surveillance device a constant informant to government about people's movements and whereabouts, it still remains remarkably founded on an optional criterion. I don't leave where I live very much these days, like much of the rest of the human race. I have been abroad only twice in the last 10 days for short periods of time and for a few hundred meters each. But it would never occur to me to carry a mobile phone, let alone a smartphone, on any of those activities. It's pretty much unnecessary at the moment for a person to have a thing called a mobile phone. Which again causes me to wonder, why do you have them? You see the way in which in this period, the plague time, governments throughout the world are going to make additional efforts to use your carefully purchased, carefully charged, constantly carried object against you. Why don't you just stop? Anyway, the form of mass surveillance of movements, the reduction of the public space to surveilled space, the closure of the idea of just going around in one's own society without, will be a casualty of the plague time. And it is unlikely that all of the forms of additional surveillance will be removed. So here again, we come to a kind of government asymmetry which will only increase in the next period of your life, further increasing the implicit power of the state to sanction on the basis of a kind of knowledge about movements, contacts, capabilities, and intentions, which has in the past traditionally been reserved for other people's militaries and other people's governments. I wanted also to call attention in this context to the Zoomification of society. Doc Searls, who's an old friend of mine, is a technology journalist and a man with a long history in both tech and writing about tech. His observation of the meaning of the Zoom privacy policy will not surprise any privacy lawyer or indeed anybody who's ever read a privacy policy. It is designed to allow Zoom to say, in the face of any regulatory inquiry, that it has promised to pillage you using language which, from the point of view of the privacy regulator, clearly says we can do whatever the hell we want, while reassuring you that Zoom cares a great deal about your privacy. But what Doc is pointing to more than that is what the obscure language actually denotes, that is to say, what the extent is of the surveillance of human communications being conducted by Zoom for the purpose of informing advertisers who communicates with whom, about what, for how long, when, and why. Which, as you are aware, is now also who teaches whom what, asks what questions, attends what classes, is connected to what other people in the learning environment. It's an astounding assault upon educational privacy and the freedom of thought. Well, of course, we're not astounded by the assault because we take so much for granted the presence of commercial surveillance, and we're not offended because the only purpose is to make money, and so what that your educational institution to which you paid money, called tuition, under the assumption that it obeyed an educational privacy law called FERPA, has decided instead to throw you to the wolves. But no questions, really? Nothing to see here? Move on? We've moved online, all our classes, nothing to see here about the consequences for the privacy of education and the freedom of the mind? Nothing, 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 nothing at all. It's this, I would say, is astounding. Even to me, to someone who thinks about these questions all the time and watches everybody else learning how not to think about these questions under any circumstances, even under those circumstances, this is quite an extraordinary public act of dissociation of the obvious by smart people. Now, naturally, there was a heroic improvisation involved in Zoomifying the university. Everybody went from zero to hero in online education, no time flat. And, of course, the purpose of Zoom is to make data mining free conferencing as expensive as possible. But still, it's a fascinating example of the refusal to accept any form of public responsibility on the part of those people who don't know shit about technology and who love to throw it around. Could we have had equivalent video conferencing for Columbia Law School without Zoomification and the resulting privacy disaster? Yes, of course we could. Jitsi Meet would have done everything we needed. Free software, running on our own computers, doing it our own way. I don't do that here because I'm a video conferencing skeptic altogether and don't think that it improves my pedagogy over what it is that we're doing here. But if everybody wrote to me overnight and said, no, you don't understand, video conferencing is the way to go, I could, I think, without a lot of trouble, put Jitsi Meet up and have us all using the Chrome browser and sharing only with Google a week from now. But as you see, even that, you know, would involve all our various choices about which browser made by which advertising company we use in which device that's already spying on us. And really, it would be better to figure out how to engineer education so that fewer people were spying on fewer students, not the other way around. At any rate, this, after all, is merely another demonstration of the way in which information asymmetry is self-reinforcing, in which the fact that there are parties, whether they are private parties or public parties, with increasing insight into everybody's behavior will eventually result in further inequality in knowledge between the state and the citizens, and therefore an inequality which will be exploited by power to, in the minds of 18th century British North Americans, use the most powerful of the state's means of ultimate social control, that is the violence monopolized by the state through the criminal justice system, for the purpose of controlling society in ways that democracy would not achieve, attempt, or approve. Now, this, the question of asymmetry in the information flows that allow the state to exercise its power, this stretches far beyond the criminal law in particular, or the Sixth Amendment in particular, or the Anglo-American world in particular. We're really now talking about the grand issue which justifies all of us in sharing this course that never meets together, namely the role of that collection of information in the shifting of power overall from citizens to states across the range of states and the types of citizens the world possesses, from the most to the least economically privileged, from the most to the least educationally privileged, and of course from the most civil liberties observing to the least civil liberties observing of societies. I don't mean to go all the way from the particular banalities of the Anglo-American criminal defense bar circa 1776 to the general problem of the allocation of the power between citizens and the state by way of one set of Sixth Amendment problems, but I do want to say that the problem the 18th century designer is attempting to solve using language out of late 17th century statutes and the new customary habituation to the presence of defense counsel in Anglo-American criminal process in the 18th century, the problem that the Constitution maker is trying to solve is a generic problem which in the 21st century we must now experience and solve in different ways. Obviously, we can take the ideas of the Sixth Amendment, publicity and speediness of trial and the assistance of counsel and the cross-examination or testing of evidence, and we can take them only a little bit more generically than the readers of the Treason Act of 1697 might want to take them. We can see the question of access to information about justice in the public, the impartiality of fact finders, the problem of too much government research and too much knowledge of the community out of which the jury is drawn, the difficulties of deciding when it is sufficient to see a witness on video or when it is necessary for the witness to be confronting the defendant, however harmful to the defendant that may be, harmful to the witness that may be. All of these questions are, after all, questions about the structure in which information flows between citizens, witnesses, and the state with respect to invocations of the violence allowed to the state for the punishment of crime. We are aware that at the edge that shades off into political offenses and the state's ability to punish dissent, but that's less important in a way than the question of where all that information is collected and how it is undertaken or produced. For example, if we were to ask, what does the Confrontation Clause mean with respect to a set of facts that the government establishes by getting movement data, behavior data from the one, two, or three oligopolists most capable of possessing it through power of subpoena, what then should we understand to be the right to confront that evidence? How should we understand the role of those constant information intermediaries, all those parties being subpoenaed, the Googles and the Facebooks of the world? How should we understand them with respect to a criminal justice process that they more and more thoroughly will be embedded in? Right now, almost all criminal prosecutions occurring in the United States have a cell phone in there somewhere. Forensic analysis of mobile phones that have been acquired at arrest or in discovery in civil cases or in other respects, analysis of mobile phones and their contents is a constant new undergirding of what it is we know about the world. Who called whom, when, who texted whom, when, saying what, all sorts of information which at the moment may be acquired from an intermediary third party's data store or may be acquired from the physical device which is connected to a person, connected to a crime or a transaction or an occurrence in the world. Over time, in the near future, years, not decades, the former source of information becomes infinitely more important than the latter less. Devices contain less data. It's all in the cloud, which actually means it's all in the data storage of a few oligopolistic service providers. It's true that the devices I carry around with me in the world have very little data in them. That's deliberate. But the data isn't in the cloud, meaning at Google, at Facebook, at Twitter, at, you know, Dropbox. The data sits peacefully on my cloud's data store. That is to say, my devices are communicating securely with storage, which is maintained by me securely, on hard drives which are encrypted at rest and which are being read in certain security-conscious ways in action. And if you want my data, good luck to you. You can serve a search warrant. You can physically take the hard drives, but you must have a really good team in the world to go to work on those, and probably you won't get there. Nonetheless, of course, that's just me. That's somebody actually trying to do it right. The human race consists of very few people trying to do it right and an awful lot of people trying to get convenience, and by convenience here, what we mean is the storage of their data in a form which is convenient to the people who ransack it for information about them. Those parties, the data miners, are, by the middle of the 21st century, indeed by the end of the first third of it, pretty much the witnesses of first resort for pretty much everything, pretty much all the time. You want to know what people have done? You want to know what they said to other people while they were doing it? All of that information is to be found not at the telephone companies, who possess only social graph information, de-anonymizing information, if you please, but the content intermediaries, the people who own all the email boxes and the, well, you know. And at a certain point, of course, then the question how to test the accuracy of the information they present becomes a severe problem, because there's really no witness you can expect to be able to call from Google who will testify that, yes, indeed, this information is genuine and that nobody messed with it. All that they will do is that say that it is records kept in the ordinary course of their business, and they presume them to be accurate, and they won't send a human being to testify to that because they don't have to. The process of determining whether forensic labs have actually processed the evidence presented about hairs or blood splatters or whatever it is in itself a great challenge. The 20th century learned to have labs and to celebrate them, but it didn't learn to test their output very well. Through the work of the Innocence Project and other places at the end of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st, people began to pay some attention to the enormous reservoirs of error, uncertainty, and corruption that lay underneath the smooth chain of custody and evidence reports of the nation's crime labs. We can be sure, of course, that the subject is inexhaustible if it is both error and corruption, as the historians of the Roman law have proved. If those are your two subjects, you needn't consider any systemic features of the legal system beyond them centuries on end. But the problem here, if you like, again, is that problem of asymmetry. The government benefits from the largely unquestionable nature of the evidence rendered from the platform companies. A, it has superior access to the data of the platform companies. Its prosecutors' subpoenas are promptly and completely obeyed. But more than that, the platform companies are, in the end, the determiners of the constitutional limits of criminal procedure. You can see this clearly in the counterterrorism investigations after events have occurred, in which the spooks will have, in all likelihood, a bunch of information that the prosecutors wish to admit in court about the activities of people who shot up some place or set off a bomb or whatever. But the spooks will not render that evidence, and at least under what used to be the rules of criminal procedure in the United States, that they will have difficulty admitting that evidence, even if they were prepared to testify about how they got it, which they won't be. And so the prosecutors must alibi what the intelligence services have told them by reacquiring evidence that they cannot admit from an intelligence source. And thus, Apple becomes responsible for either being willing to, quote, unlock iPhones or not willing to unlock iPhones. And Facebook becomes either willing or unwilling to backdoor the WhatsApp communications of the world by not providing the Facebook Messenger messaging of the world by not providing the same degree of communication security that it applies through the signal algorithms in WhatsApp, or perhaps becomes required as under certain investigative powers laws in despotic places like the People's Republic of China and the United Kingdom, for secretly including listeners in private messaging groups so that they can get the message traffic without having to break the encryption. All of these different practices and undertakings and institutions of relationship between the oligopolistic platform companies in various societies and the governments of those societies, all of that is communicated on frequencies that criminal defense practitioners and individual citizens trying to mount a defense against government charges will never be able to achieve. It may be the defendant's right to compel testimony from Google or Facebook or Apple or the telecoms giants about how particular data was produced, which is subsequently entered in evidence and used against them, but their subpoenas will result in mere cookie-cutter communications, which will not involve successfully dragging CEOs into court and making them testify about the practices which connect them to the prosecutorial system or whatever. This is beyond imagination, even in the most advanced democracies in the world, let alone in other places in which the rights of informational symmetry between the defendant and the state are less formally recognized, let alone practically observed. The role of the data mining intermediaries in the criminal justice system is not quite like the role of the telephone companies in a 20th century that came to be dominated in criminal investigations by wiretapping. In the case of the telephone companies in the 20th century, they did allow access to their physical networks and therefore recording of conversations on particular circuits by particular police entities who were either in the possession of or could have been in the possession of court orders to allow that physical access. They were, after all, parties being searched. But the role of the data mining intermediaries in the 21st century is a little bit different. The telephone companies, of course, wanted people to use telephones. They wanted to sell their services, but they didn't actually have themselves an enormous stake in spying on their customers and increasing their customers' ability to be spied on. The platform companies engage in eliciting behavioral information from people and causing them to form habits which will create more behavioral information. That this is what I have described as the behavior of the parasite with the mind of God. But the companies which are physiological organs in the parasite with the mind of God are also engaged in what we might, under other circumstances, think of as entrapping behavior. They're constantly eliciting confession. They're constantly engaged in the attempt to get people to tell them things which sensible people would never, ever, 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 ever tell them. They are the stool pigeons, ne plus ultra, the supreme of pigeon, if you like, And we have come to regard them as necessary infrastructure, which is not exactly the way one ordinarily would think about the large-scale invasion of society by police informants. Now, of course, it's also true that they're not just police informants. They are by no means engaged simply in police informing for profit. They sell that information to other better-heeled parties. But that doesn't, for our purposes, elide the fact that the fundamental asymmetry growing in society, informationally speaking, between the state and those whom it accuses is the overwhelming dependence of everybody on a whole bunch of people who, for these purposes, are well on their way to being the witnesses of first resort to all human behavior. This isn't what the Constitution makers were primarily concerned about, of course. They are primarily concerned about government tyranny. And there is a sense in which, like the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment, the difficulty here isn't so much that government has changed what it is trying to do or why it is trying to do it, but rather that the people have changed their understanding about why the preservation of their rights depends upon the maintenance of their own habits. But this is weak with respect to the Sixth Amendment context because, of course, very few of us behave as though we were criminal defendants in waiting. The law school T-shirt handed out famously, if apocryphally, at Harvard Law School one fall at orientation, statistically speaking, more of you will be criminal defendants than criminal defense lawyers, contains an accurate truth, which I, as a teacher, would hope somehow to play some role in undermining. But even all of us who actually were drawn to criminal defense work in law school and who may have but for the grace of God go I feeling about certain classes of criminal defendants, even we do not actually live our life politically and constitutionally year in, year out from the perspective of potential criminal defendants. But our constitutional regime, as Felix Frankfurter said once in a majority opinion, our constitutional liberties have frequently been formed in controversies involving not very nice people. We are, in that sense, indebted for civil liberty not merely to the rules about criminal trials and the people who need them, but to our general understanding, our what we might think of as folk libertarian suspicion, that the power of the state to control its population using violence in the interest of suppressing or punishing crime will in the end be turned inevitably at one place and time or another in corrupt and oppressive directions. And if in that sense the Sixth Amendment is a reminder that the 18th century British North Americans saw criminal prosecution and the control of information related to it as the shortest route to despotism, if in the 21st century we will say that we have many other pathways to despotism, of which that is only one, and perhaps for most of us not the most worrying at any given moment, it is intensely important nonetheless. And all of us concerned about freedom in whatever context we are concerned about it will ultimately also have to be concerned about this, because it is only control over the integrity of criminal justice which makes the state accountable in any fundamental way at all. Once the system of criminal justice has been corrupted by politicization, by bribery, by any form of the undermining of its integrity, then the rule of law itself is challenged in every other context, because the state's asymmetric possession of the power of legitimate violence worked through the criminal law can be used to form an acid which washes away any other institution that the people may choose to build. And that's the structure in which an effort to understand criminal trial rights in the age of the internet is really an effort to understand the bulwark protections of the rule of law. And this is where the words of the 18th century legislator have, once again, a kind of hopeful feeling. If we think of the Sixth Amendment as limited to trial rights, if we are not attempting to generalize beyond it, then its effort to secure a free flow of information and impartial observers is sufficient. That is to say, it isn't that the concepts have lost their meaning as search and seizure have been twisted out of the realm of the Fourth Amendment context by change in technology. The cases that we should expect to need to bring are cases in which the meaning of those words is operationally redefined under 21st century technological conditions. What is a public trial? What is sufficient confirmation in a world of virtual communication structures? How far may the state claim use of the data miners as research intermediaries while still resulting in the choice of impartial juries, and so on? But in each case, we have a clarity of the concept. We know its role in the criminal justice process, which has changed sufficiently little over hundreds of years, that we can recognize the 18th century concepts in their 21st century operational form, and we can write the constitutional provisions into our current common law structure in an effective way. We can have cases about whether a particular form of virtual presence in a courtroom is sufficient confrontation to secure the constitutional rights of the defendant, while also doing justice to the human needs and the dignity of witnesses. We can decide whether a public trial can only occur when there are real members of the public physically present in a real courtroom, and so on. A step further, in an effort to see the Sixth Amendment as one of a series of working parts concerning asymmetry of information in the disposition of government power, we can also be coherent about. We can say criminal justice process and the criminal evidence process are part of a general structure in which the state makes information available in order to equalize power between itself and its citizens. And we can recognize then the ways in which Sixth Amendment trial rights in the criminal justice process are also related to rights in adversary or prosecutorial style administrative proceedings. And we can begin to reason about ways in which keeping track of how individuals relate to the state, comprehensively defining a human being's existence in relation to all the transactions that occur with respect to the state, the traffic policeman and the paramilitary warden and the parties who have obligations of disclosure and information in their administrative relationship to the state, from the automobile junkyards to the pharmacies and so on. How if we were not aware of any constitutional moving parts that would restrict the state's ability to unify its information with respect to all the ways in which we deal with it, if we have no such restrictions embedded in our fabric of constitutional thinking, then we shall, within one generation, find ourselves living in societies in which every interaction with the state is remembered forever and is correlated with all other interactions with the state at any level or purpose. And another form of alternate identity has come into existence for us, which is our existence in relation to the state, which the state knows better than we do. Part of the so-called India stack, the technological structure of state services and powers of identification which has grown up in India in the Modi regime. Part of the India stack is a so-called locker containing documents of value to the individual in relation to the state, right? Birth certificates and marriage certificates and so on, but also the ration card records that allow access to life subsidies and information about state educational rights and activities and so on. In response to the coronavirus epidemic crisis, the Indian government has been reminding its citizens in the last week that they should eschew the use of paper documents and rely as much as possible only in future upon the electronic versions of their materials contained in their cloud lockers with the Indian state. This at the same time, of course, that there has been convulsion in Indian politics over the possibility of a national register of citizens that would require people to prove the long-term presence of their families as Indians in India over generations, which has already resulted in the northeastern states where citizenship registration has begun in lots of denationalization of people who simply didn't have a way of proving where their grandfathers lived or under what diplomatic circumstances. The paper records may be scanned, and the use of electronic records as an alternative may be a good idea, but when the state is encouraging people to discard or do away with paper records on the grounds that they're unsanitary, they're also awarding themselves even more asymmetry of power than they had before. When your locker disappears, when the state decides to modify or remove documents from it, even though it has claimed that it will not do that, what is your recourse when the original paper records have ceased to be? As we move towards a world in which data intermediaries, whether they are public or private, become actually sole repositories, not just intermediaries, and where it is impossible without their assistance to reconstruct social reality, under those circumstances, what should be the constitutional limits on the state's ability to tinker with those intermediary sole repositories? What is the constitutional protection against the destruction of the citizens' informational life? This is, of course, not merely a trial rights question, not merely an American question, certainly not merely a Sixth Amendment question. This is the problem of the world in which information is power, and power is not in the people, but in their avatars, their data trails, their government-supported, government-created, government-regulated structures of recorded living. I'm averse to the effort to turn that into merely a matter of legal rules or technicalities. I don't mean to suggest that if we correctly balanced for 21st century purposes the rules of criminal trial, that we would significantly affect the ongoing disaster of the destruction of human privacy. The state is, in the end, the guarantor of the values which we can use to fight this war. The state is the repository of the principles that ought to be available to us in asserting our individual dignity and our individual power over information flows in all sorts of relationships in life. The Sixth Amendment by itself neither adjusts correctly to 21st century conditions nor is incapable of such adjustment. It is an example of a part of the constitutional order, the one we happen to have in this particular constitutional republic. It's an example of one of the parts which requires adaptation and which can adapt, which needs to be reformed or restructured or new denotations offered to its nouns, but which is still an idea solid in its understanding and its relationship to our other understandings. If we do not protect rights to information flows, publicity and impartiality, and the assistance of counsel in connection with the state's use of legitimate violence for the purpose of controlling crime, we will not succeed in adjusting other things, right? We will not be able to carry superstructure of civil liberties along without the base rights that were identified in the course of the late 17th century in England as crucial to the ability to maintain freedom. It is not in the Sixth Amendment that the habeas right is located. But it is clear that the writers of the Constitution and those who sought to increase its respect for civil liberties understood, as so many other 18th century English speakers did, that habeas corpus and the ability at any time to make government responsible for the confinement of its citizens before neutral magistrates in court is the crowning effort in this branch of sustaining the rule of law. And it's not surprising in that sense that habeas also has an information theory structure to it, but the structure places the entire burden upon government. Having established only the fact of confinement, the Great Writ leaves all other matters of information disclosure at the responsibility of the state and at the inquiry of the judge. And this, that same principle, that nobody confined should need to have anything more to say about his confinement than that he is confined and government must answer for the deed, that is in itself the radical symmetry that only habeas corpus provides in the long history of not just English law, but Western law, and why that great Brexiteer Samuel Johnson was so convinced that the only thing that really separated English freedom from French despotism was the writ. So here then, we are simply observing about a foundation stone of constitutional liberty, that it is still there, that it still maintains itself as it ought to in this new world of ours, that we can give the appropriate modifications to its terms to make it valuable, but it will not define for us, neither in its particular Sixth Amendment form nor in any constitutional form. Criminal process guarantees are a necessary but not even relatively sufficient set of conditions for constitutional liberty in the 21st century, in the networked society, in the world of the parasite with the mind of God and big data analysis of all human behavior. We can see the ways in which the high water mark against which despotism will always seek to overleap can be set in this way and can be made continually relevant in this way. But we cannot use it to go further and to figure out which new rights we need. Its list is valuable but closed. So what remains to us in this course, this class that does not meet, this theoretical meeting of minds, what remains to us in this truncated term is to go in search of those new rights. The structure between the sufficiency of the Bill of Rights in our historic past and the insufficiency of the Bill of Rights as an inventory, as a manifest of rights, for the society of our future. So I propose to spend these next last weeks with more tech projects, to be sure, but also on the portions of our constitutional structure which are the expander bolts, which allow, encourage, necessitate the revision of the manifest of rights, the reconsideration of the particulars within which we confine the state for the purpose of securing individual freedom. Parts 9 and 14 then are about the forms of rights expansion of a substantive kind that have occurred or can occur under the American constitutional frame, and which, though they are, God knows, like all the other parts, peculiar to the constitutional history of the United States, are nonetheless also reflections of underlying constitutional concepts, principles, modes of thought, which exist in every system, regardless of the particular words in which they are expressed. The role of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment in the constitutional history of the United States is immense beyond measurement. And curious, not beyond historical account, but so curious that only historical account can set forth how it came to be. The Ninth Amendment has a different form of curiousness, that like the curiousness of the half-disappearing smile of the Cheshire Cat, almost there, not quite present, never entirely absent, and yet somehow indefinably non-existent. To understand how the greatest of the expansion principles of the Constitution has become the least known and the least thought about part is, of course, not a story only of irony. There is also some purpose in it. But for us, confronting this challenge socio-technologically to our existing constitutional order, the question before the House is, if we must build, how do we build? What is the process of constitutional replication? The coronavirus, we know, it replicates in the back of the throat, moves downward and outward, and brings human society to a halt. We assume that our constitutional machinery is both a little less efficient and a little more positively purposive. But here we are meeting in the time of the virus to make a constitution for a world we inhabit but do not understand. I look forward to trying to bring a little more clarity to this darkness in the weeks to come. Thank you. Talk to you soon.